Welcome, everybody. Hope you're all enjoying your conversation. Good food. Welcome to Dallas Philosophers Forum. I'm Skip Kilmer. I'm on the board of the Dallas Philosophers Forum, and we are a lecture and discussion group which is well into our fourth decade of having these kind of meetings. We bring philosophy, ideas, intellectual discussion to an interested and educated audience in the DFW area. These talks are designed to be engaging, non-technical, and thus they're enjoyable by the lay person or the academician. Philosophy made user-friendly. David Drum is our treasurer, and he'll be happy to receive your admission fees if you haven't had a chance to pay yet. Admissions, $5. If you're a student with an ID, it's only $2. There's also a $35 fee if you want to join for 6 months. We've been meeting at El Phoenix for a number of years, at least as long as I've been in this group, about 10 years, and they're kind enough to provide this space for us. So if you have ordered from the menu, please pay your bill so that we don't have to. Also, take care of your wait staff. They work hard for us. Tonight's lecture is the woman question, which will take about 45 minutes, followed by Q&A. And if you have questions, please keep your background remarks as brief as you can. Give the speaker a chance to answer as many questions as possible. Tonight's speaker is Nancy Barlow, who received her Master of Arts degree from UTD in Humanities with emphasis on the history of ideas. Philosophy hooked her early and hasn't let go. She's taught at Brookhaven College for 30 years. Her primary position is as English teacher, but she's taught at least 10 years of history and occasionally teaches philosophy in special programs. She's an RN with 13 years experience, mostly in emergency rooms, back when that was a medical innovation. She has three adult children and a husband who is dearly beloved and her best friend. Please join me in welcoming Nancy Barlow.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you for inviting me, and thank you, Skip. Joe and I are very much enjoying the hospitality. Can I turn this on?
Yes.
I might be able to do without it, but if it goes, it's a good thing. Oh, yeah. Okay. Cataract surgery, new glasses, you know, not sure about this. Okay. Well, since I believe that there is no philosopher that surpasses Calvin and Hobbes, I have opened the first slide with an old cartoon, and I have discovered that you can find anything on the internet. This was so old that you couldn't read it. So now you can't. Can you see it in the back, or shall I read this? All right. So Hobbes says, "What happened to your head?" Calvin says, "Evidently, an unanticipated physiological consequence of cerebral augmentation, my brain swelled." And the tiger says, "If your hats don't fit, will you give them to me?" And Calvin says, "My powerful brain is unraveling the mysteries of the universe. It's amazing. All natural laws can be reduced to one simple unifying equation. Really, what is it? Already my powerful brain is bored with such simple problems and is working on why girls are so obnoxious." Well, forgive some personal reflections, but I'd like to begin with a little bit of me in this. And I believe that a lot of what I will say will resonate with women of my generation. In 1960, women vital to the world, to a victory in World War II, women whose legs had been measured to be sure that they could reach the pedals of the John Deere tractors, women who farmed, built airplanes, worked in factories while the boys were over there, women who had been politely thanked for their service, laid off, fired, and invited back to the kitchen, those women were quietly urging their daughters, me, and some of you perhaps, to get an education. Don't be dependent. And the only way you could do that was to get an education. they enjoyed that independence that they had during World War II, and they wanted it for us. In 1960, when I graduated from high school, girls could realistically expect education after high school to be nursing, teaching, or business school to be a secretary. Not an office administrator at the time, secretary. Now, by 1965, that was beginning to change a little bit. Meanwhile, in nurses training in a big city hospital, I encountered almost daily what I later learned would be called the ultimate questions of philosophy. What's the meaning of life? Why do people suffer? The famous book title was, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? And perhaps less profound, why were there so few women doctors? And for that matter, why were there so few male nurses? I knew one of each in my years in nurses training. Now, over my 3 years in training in St. Louis with a friend, I visited nearly every church and synagogue in the city. Every single denomination, from Methodist, Presbyterians, Baptists, you name it, all of them had answers. Well, maybe not the Unitarians. They didn't have all the answers. But overall, they didn't help much in the face of what we were seeing in the hospital every day. Once, about halfway through my training, I had a nun for a patient. She was one of the Sisters of Notre Dame. They had a school there in St. Louis. And I talked with her. She was a nice lady, and she put up with the student nurse. And so I expressed to her my confusion, and she was no help at all. If you have not questioned the existence of God by the time you're 18, Sister said, you're either a liar or a fool. So, permission to question. And that Presbyterian kid that I was, the one that secretly rejected predestination at age 12, I ran with that and I haven't stopped questioning yet. Now, in 1963, I went to Germany to marry my soldier, not the doctor my mother wished I had married, ardently wished I had married. On the plane, let me see if I can change sides here. Yeah. I carried with me Betty Friedan's new book, The Feminine Mystique, given me by that church-hopping friend. And I think Feminine Mystique was probably the first philosophy book that I ever really read. Friedan graduated from Smith College in 1942, the year I was born. And for her 15th college reunion, she surveyed her classmates, then say about 37 years old, and she asked about their experiences after college and whether their lives had been fulfilling and were they satisfied with their current status. She documented the unhappiness of suburban housewives and their feelings of being unappreciated and unfulfilled. She published articles on what she called the problem with no name. And she got passionate responses from many housewives across the country, grateful that they were not alone in suffering this depressing feeling that they had, this problem that pervaded suburbia at the time. Now, other writers at the time, and there were many of them, decried higher education for women, believing that it's, and arguments were made, believing that it subverted women's willingness and their ability to carry out traditional roles as wives and mothers. You don't want to be too smart, girls. You know, how are you going to get a husband? And this was not exaggerated. The so-called feminine mystique was that girls did the girl thing. They stayed home. They were wives. They were mothers. They kept the house clean. They did the boys, etc. And that had prescribed the role of women for, well, forever. Betty Friedan says the problem that has no name, which is simply the fact that American women are kept from growing to their full human capacities, is taking a far greater toll on the physical and mental health of our country than any known disease. And she goes on the only kind of work which permits an able woman to realize her abilities fully, to achieve identity in society, in a life plan that can, underlines mine, can encompass marriage and motherhood, is the kind that was forbidden by the feminine mystique. A lifelong commitment to an art or science, to politics or profession. And those were the things that women had been closed off from. Now, jumping forward, in 1975, a friend and I, both stay-at-home moms, registered for a Saturday History 1302 class at Richland College. Just for fun. That was it. Just for fun. Get us out of the house on Saturday. Our professor was a woman named Dorothy Masterson. I don't know if anybody knows Dorothy Masterson, knows of her. At the time, she was a social activist for fair rental practices here in Dallas, and she was one heck of a good history teacher. About midway through the semester, she announced that we were going to have a debate on the Equal Rights Amendment, a hot current issue. And Alice and I knew we could make a dynamite argument for it. The crowd we ran with at the time considered it a done deal, just waiting for the process to work its way through. "Oh no, Mrs. Barlow," Dr. Masterson said, and I remember it like it was yesterday, "you'll argue against." Alice got to argue for her. I got to argue against, had to argue against. Well, being a fairly competitive person, I wouldn't have let Alice beat me. I mean, that wouldn't have done it all. Couldn't do that. I was going to out-argue her at all costs. So, as we are now telling our students, dive into the complexity of the issue. And that's exactly what I did. And I knew with complete certainty in the fall semester of 1975 that the ERA would not pass. And I went home and told Joe, "We need to write a check for $100 to the National Organization for Women because they're going to need it." And $100 for us at the time was a lot of money. Now, what did I learn that made me so sure? I learned about conservative, constitutional scholar, anti-feminist Phyllis Schlafly. Phyllis Schlafly, kind of a person that all of us in the liberal, gonna pass the ERA camp, discounted completely. We were wrong. And I also learned how right David Hume was when he said, "Reason is and ought to be the slave of passion." Schlafly formed the Stop ERA campaign, Stop Taking Our Rights. She claimed the ERA could lead to drafting women, taking away dependent wife benefits under Social Security, separate restrooms for males and females could disappear. She was out early in opposition, and she was vocal and emotional, and she played to irrational fear. Many who followed that movement believe that without her, that's okay, I fall apart a lot these days, believe that the ERA would have passed without Schlafly's influence. Emotion won in that. Now, here's where we are. You know, like I said, that the friends that we had at the time thought these 1924 words, simple, self-evident, equality of rights under the law shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex. Who can argue with that? Plenty of people could and did. Self-evident? Not. Absolutely not. 38 states needed to ratify, and Texas did. Only 35 ratified by 1982, which was an extended deadline. It was originally 79, and Congress extended it, I think. However, in 2017, Nevada ratified. In May of this year, Illinois ratified. Technically, the ERA's dead. But what happens if one more state ratifies? The only state on the list that even looked like it might be possible was Missouri. The rest of them were deep south. But who knows? Who knows? then it might be a situation where Congress would simply ditch it and come up with a new one and would have to be ratified all over again, and in which case it probably would die rather quickly. But who knows? Who knows? So, Dr. Masterson had me hooked. And I began to study in earnest at Richland College in philosophy. Early on, I took an intro class. And I noted, as we were talking a little earlier, not a single woman was represented in the readings in my intro book. And I studied a lot of philosophy in the next few years. Well, the next 8 or 10 years, actually. Nary a woman. We weren't reading Simone de Beauvoir. We weren't reading any of the ancient women philosophers. Not one. And in grad school, they warned me quite early when I was deciding which direction to take. And again, that took me a long time to finish. But they warned me not to expect opportunities for women philosophers. And I never had a woman professor in the field. Not one. Why? Why? That's the big question. Why? So somewhere along the line, and nobody could really tell me, the male professors couldn't say, well, they just aren't recognized, or they're not good enough to be in the book. Somewhere along the line, I decided I needed to trace the history of the ideas concerning women. If you know UT Dallas, the degree, the master's degree in the history of ideas is a degree that combines history, philosophy, aesthetics, and literature, and you focus in the field that you're interested in. So I decided to study philosophy for a while, and of course you start with Plato, since Western philosophy more or less begins with him, and he articulated ideas that people still write dissertations about, or as Bertrand Russell claimed, footnotes. All philosophy is a footnote to Plato. The status of women in Athens during Plato's time was little better than that of its slaves. They were cut off from duties of citizenship, rewards of citizenship. They were confined to their home. A respectable woman was raised for marriage, arranged by her father, expected to produce legitimate heirs, you know, the whole thing. An endless round of domestic trivia. Familiar territory to the women of the 50s and 60s? Absolutely. What changed? 3,000 years. Not much. However, Plato, in the Republic, says these things. The status of women is a perversion of nature and a waste of half the resources of half the population. Nothing inherent in women's nature prevents her from engaging in the social functions of the citizen, even those of the philosopher king. If women are expected to do the same work as men, we must teach them the same things. Hello? Education for women? Once made equal to man, woman becomes his superior. I don't know. There's a little bit of trepidation going on there. A little bit of fear injected. So far, it sounds pretty good. It's promising. But what happened? Later in the Timaeus, Plato seems to backtrack a little bit and claim that women are weaker and have inferior souls. So there's one clue. But Plato, scribe for Socrates, some of his own ideas, but Socrates, a student who wrote things down, Plato didn't seem to have too much bad to say about women. Now we come to Aristotle, the student of Plato, who is absolutely opposed to what his teacher says about women. He's devoted to Plato, but he is not where Plato is on women. Everything Plato says about the equality of women in society as a family, all of that talk, Aristotle rejects. And he wrote that woman is an incomplete man. A thesis that has a long and persistent history, culminating in Sigmund Freud, influential psychological theories about women in the 20th century. Aristotle accepts ancient Greek pre-Socratic view that women are colder than men. This goes back even to some of those relatively obscure philosophers that came before Plato. Women are colder than men. Now, strangely, if you look this, if you Google this, women are colder than men. You know, there's some scientific stuff going on about that right now. I'm sorry. What do I need to do? Just talk about it?
Colder
than men. So here's how he talks about this. He associates vital heat with the life force, with soul. You see where this is going? He supposes women have less soul than men, based on this heat business. Now, because they lack this heat, Aristotle was a scientist, remember? Because they lack this heat to cook their vital secretion, meaning menstrual blood, men, therefore, contributed the pure components for life via the sperm, and women merely provided the nutrients for the embryo to grow. Sounds silly today, but I must not commit the Shapley fallacy and discount the emotion involved in that way of thinking. So it is naturally with the male and the female. The one is superior, the other inferior, the one governs, the other is governed, and the same rule must necessarily hold good with respect to all mankind. That's in the Politics. A proper wife should be as obedient as a slave. The female is a female by virtue of a certain lack of qualities, a natural defectiveness. Now, we're talking here about the ancients, so now I'm going to move forward a little bit. But from the ancient times of Western thought, these are the ideas that come forward. Now, there is evidence that they existed prior to Plato and Aristotle. But to come into Western society, it's via Aristotle and Plato. Going forward, Aristotle was immensely influential in Western thought through the church and his revived writings that came to the West in around 400 via the Islamic world. Islamic scholars translated Aristotle into Latin so that it could be read in Europe. So way before Cicero and Plato and other ancient writers reached the West, Aristotle was pretty firmly entrenched in church thinking because they were looking for ways to incorporate the ideas into the church thinking. Now about Aristotle's acclaimed science, just an aside here, Bertrand Russell says, Aristotle maintained that women have fewer teeth than men. And although he twice married, it never occurred to him to verify the statement by examining his crystals. Now, there's little argument that traditional Christianity believed that this statement, women were created second, sinned first, and should keep silence, that's attributed to St. Paul in 1 Timothy. And traditional Christianity believed from, I don't know how long, that this was doctrine, that this was the universal consensus of the early church and Jesus. Women, traditionalists believe, should simply accept these teachings as truth. I mean, Jesus said it, but Timothy, St. Paul reported it, Timothy agrees with it, hey, this is the way it is. And it was the predominant view of women in the church until quite recently. And I think in our lifetimes we know the church has changed and is changing, but up until, quite recently, that was the traditional belief. Now, during Paul, the years of Paul's intense ministry, missionary work in the middle of the first century AD, he wrote to the Corinthian Christians for the purpose of settling local disputes. And he addresses issues of universal interest to the struggling young Christian church, still in its infancy. As to the status of women, he adheres to the traditional Jewish practice of enforcing women's subordinate position, restricting her movement, lest she use her sexuality to ensnare men. We're going to come back to that idea in a little bit. But Paul relies heavily on Genesis and the account of creation and the fall to support this pronouncement. However, and this is kind of interesting to me, in the New Testament, Jesus doesn't say anything derogatory about women. I mean, you can't find it. He doesn't say it. His comments show no contemptuous attitudes. And many times, he treated women with respect in ways that startled onlookers. They couldn't quite believe he was doing this. There is evidence in the early church that women engaged in teaching and in conversion practices, converting large numbers of people to Christianity. Okay, so that sounds promising. But my question remains, what happened? So here we are at the beginning of the Common Era, and no real answers yet in philosophy, in the philosophers. Why? If anybody wants to stop me at any time, we can interject if you need to. Now we go to Plutarch during the first century AD. Attitudes toward women in Greece and Rome seem to soften a little bit when you read some of the stories and things that come down to us from the day. Women seem to have more control of property. They might be able to buy or sell property just a bit. A little more access to education during those early years of the early church. Plutarch was a Greek who spent a lot of time in Rome, and he reflects the desirability of continuation of these restrictive patriarchal practices of the past. And he wrote a letter called Conjugal Precepts, and it was a letter written to a young couple on the occasion of their marriage. Here's what he said. He specifies the ideal for married life. While clearly subordinate, the wife is ideally the moral and intellectual equal of her husband. Hey guys, you don't want somebody who can't talk to you in an intelligent way or sharpen a pencil or something. Intellectual equals, good, it's real good, but should not have your own likes and dislikes. She must conform in all things to the temper of her husband. Property is owned by the man, not the woman. Education in math, astronomy, philosophy for women is aimed at developing moral virtue. Paternalism continues to dominate. A wife is like a child, and her husband is both mother and father to her. Plutarch was influential. Philosophers are. What the philosophers say manages to make its way through the general populace and carries weight through their writings, through the people talking about them, and after the printing press in the 1400s, in the writings that are all over the place at that time. In 1603, the complete edition of Plutarch's Moralia was first translated into English directly from the Greek, and its influence is seen in Francis Bacon's essays, which contain counsels of public morality, private virtue, recognizably derived from Plutarch. And so the long-held view of women in the Greek and Roman world comes into early modern Europe via Francis Bacon and his influence. Now, to the churchmen, this is kind of a march, if you will, through some of these thinkers as briefly as I can do it. Augustine and Aquinas, quite different in dates. Aquinas is 354 to 430 AD, and his major work is The City of God, written in 431. And in that, like Paul, Augustine bypasses Jesus' example, and he further elaborates the implications of the Genesis story, and ironically adopts the pagan paterfamilias who rules his wife and may indeed physically punish her. It's Augustine where woman emerges in this threefold role as an instrument, temptress, wife, and mother. As the temptress, woman is the instrument of the devil. As a wife, woman is instrument of the husband. And as a mother, woman is instrument of God, the divine. Augustine, extremely influential through the church and in public life. By the 13th century, when Aquinas is writing, the medieval church has long solidified its views about women. And to justify and legitimize that doctrine, Thomas Aquinas skillfully combines Judeo-Christian and Greek traditions. The Christian acceptance of the subordinate status of women finds support in the Aristotelian idea that this is a natural state owing to man's greater rationality, man's superiority. So Aristotle's notion that woman is a defective male is supported by the creation story in the Bible. Smith, Aristotle, and the Bible go together rather perfectly. Aristotle's science of the man producing the really important ingredient in reproduction also made its way into Summa Theologica, Aquinas' big work. And it therefore provided the Roman Catholic Church with its official doctrine for centuries to come. So, at this point, a few semi-answers begin to emerge about why women have been oppressed. But are we satisfied yet? Yeah, probably not. Probably not. Francis Bacon, a man of tremendous influence in both philosophy and science, indeed called the father of empiricism, counseled to Queen Elizabeth. When he wrote on marriage and the single life in 1612, this is what he said, greatness of mind or soul are not compatible with the stirrings of the animal stirrings of sexuality. Troubles and concerns brought by women and children distract men from their public work, sapping their intellectual and material resources. It doesn't end. We keep going here for a while. But every one of these people, centuries by centuries, solidify and say again what has been said before in even more pernicious ways. Now at this time, Queen Elizabeth in England was quite a role model. Things didn't change a lot under Queen Elizabeth. The persecution of witches originated with the clergy who found a new way of expressing anti-female bias. Brutal laws rendered women totally subject to her husband without redress if he proved a tyrant, and liable to punishment if she challenged his authority. The ultimate check, said Bacon, was to avoid women altogether. And he preferred the single life, following the tradition of Paul, that celibacy is the ideal state. My favorite, Thomas Hobbes. Big line, life is nasty, brutish, and short, or something close to that, right? The social contract theory of government, which influenced very much, as you know, the American Declaration of Independence and the formation of the United States, the Constitution, began to be advanced in the 17th and 18th centuries. That is, society, together with its forms of authority, ultimately derives its existence from the consent of the governed. And that marked an important shift in attitude toward authority. Many people suspect that society and its institutions, they suspected at the time, were not natural. you know, this was not natural. This was not necessarily the way things should be. And as we were talking over dinner, there were cults of the goddess, and there were matriarchal societies prior to the time of the Greeks and the Romans. So maybe this wasn't the natural way that everything had to be. Patriarchal authority was being questioned as incompatible with freedom and dignity, and colonial governments all over the place were raising questions about the divine right of kings. Feudalism was on its way out, and Hobbes was in the forefront of this rejection of paternalism. Now, to the question of women, Hobbes argued that being a father does not logically or naturally entail being a lord. Rather, male lordship is the result of a contract of some sort of brute force. By nature, dominion is maternal for two reasons. Again, a hint here of an answer. The identity of a child's mother alone is certain. Men don't know for sure unless society is so tightly bound that women don't have any freedom of movement, of getting away. Hobbes insists that by nature, everyone is equal in the ability to overpower another, if not by physical strength, then by wit or cunning. So the male cannot claim a greater right to lordship than the female. He says no case can be made for natural patriarchal rights in a family, much less the state. Only an arbitrary agreement can cause a mother to confer such a right on a male. Now, John Locke agrees with Hobbes, but his ideas on equal rights and authority of men and women had been virtually ignored by people who adopted his other ideas wholesale. Men like Thomas Jefferson, completely ignored. When John Adams went to the Constitutional Convention, his wife Abigail said, "Don't forget the women, John." And of course, he did. Nothing in the U.S. Constitution about the equality of women. The great David Hume. So, the great philosophers of the European Enlightenment digress from the past and the church to some degree, but still, what changes? What changes? Perhaps the best philosopher of his era, Hume criticizes the social contract theory of Locke and Hobbes and others, and he denies that agreement alone can explain why some people obey others. How can we explain the fact cited by Hobbes that women have agreed in the marriage contract to give patriarchal rights to men? He agrees that men are at a disadvantage since the child is paternal, the paternity of the child is virtually impossible to prove at that time. So he turns to an argument that sounds kind of utilitarian. Men must be assured that their wives' children are their own, or they won't assist in care and education of the kids. The marriage contract can't assure this fact. The problem is ultimately, says Hume, psychological. It's ultimately psychological, established by an elaborate process of habituation beginning in infancy. If you're raised with this idea that you're inferior, how can you escape it? It's been there all your life, ladies. Immanuel Kant, the greats, the big ones, all the philosophers that people turn to when they're looking for the wisdom of the age. The idea of the ideal woman emerges in the 18th century, the lady. Remember how the Galahad and the knights in shining armor and the lady who drops a handkerchief and all of this emerges about this time in the 18th century. It was born in the Middle Ages when the aristocratic woman became the object of romantic love in chivalric literature. And she evoked courtesy and adoration. And the great Kant extols the beauty and sublimity of women, but man is still the rational half of marriage. The woman's contribution to a union was taste and charm and beauty and pleasantry. Make a nice party, girls. A nice salon, you know? Have everybody over to talk. Women have no sense of duty, he says, because they live by feeling. And this is the great moralist, let's not forget, who turns the golden rule around and says, act only in accordance with that maxim through which you can at the same time will, that it become a universal law.
Do unto others as you'd have them do unto you.
And that's what he's known for. Big ethical advance. Now, this is a good place, perhaps, to interject. From the 15th to the 18th century, the woman question was actually a term used. And it originated in France, referred to a fairly widespread intellectual debate on the nature of women, and feminist campaigns for social change began during that time. Finally, a turn, a change, a woman writing about the rights of women. Toward the end of the 18th century, in the midst of the revolutionary fever in Europe, a book destined to become the manifesto of the feminist movement in England and America during the next century, was written by Mary Wollstonecraft, who was mother to Mary Shelley, who was author of Frankenstein. Wollstonecraft wrote Vindication of the Rights of Women, published in 1792. And it was in response to another one of the Enlightenment philosophers, Rousseau, Jean-Jacques Rousseau, who held that women's virtue and nature differed considerably. So she is her work is a response to Rousseau. Rousseau laid out a program for training women based on the old idea that women were deficient in reasoning ability. Rousseau said that women's virtues were passivity, gentleness, and sensitivity. Wollstonecraft countered that since reason is the fundamental human characteristic, to deny woman a full measure of rationality amounts to denying her humanity. So, immediate change? Absolutely not. No, arguably, no prospects for women to take a turn. In fact, we're going probably to a turn to the worse. In the 1800s, the debate continued primarily by men. First theories of liberal feminism, questioning the validity of women's exclusion, was developed and formed the basis for the first feminist movements. Now, John Stuart Mill wrote The Subjection of Women in 1869, claiming no proof of the collective inferiority of women. He demands full citizenship for women, arguing that a true liberal society cannot exclude half its population. And it turns out that his wife, Harriet Mill, he gives her complete credit for having helped write the book. Mill was, in fact, a feminist. So he establishes the injustice that women face. And he believed that suffrage for women was a path forward. Full citizenship for women means they have to have the right to vote. Now, that was not a popular idea. And when I say things take a turn for the worse, there was a poem, a bad poem by somebody named Courtney Patton, something like that, called The Angel in the House. And this poem expressed all of the patriarchal ideas that had been floating around since at least Plato. And what we see here are the same old, same old. Woman belongs to the sphere of the home, taking care of the children. Now we're getting a little technical here. We've got two spheres, the outside, the world, and the home. women make the home safe, a place where their husband can come home to. Had the sweat wiped off his brow and handed a martini, perhaps? Men to come home out of that cold, cruel world and be cared for nicely. Men must shelter and protect because women are emotionally unable to do that, or physically. And here's the thing that is most interesting about this angel in the house idea that lasted until, the late 1800s, anyway. Men represent the family unit. Women don't need to vote. There's no reason for suffrage. We've had the 1848 Women's Rights Convention, where in Seneca Falls, New York, women tried to make the case. They wrote actually a mock Declaration of Independence, saying, look at us, we want the right to vote. But no, you don't need it, honey. Your man's going to take care of you for that. He'll vote and represent you. So you, though, you're not an individual. You're part of a unit. So at that time, women couldn't hold a job. Women couldn't take money for outside work. In my own home, my father would not let my mother take money for babysitting a friend's child for 2 hours after school. Of course, the friend was a teacher. No, can't take money. You can do it voluntarily. You can help your friend, but you can't take money. So liberal democracy justified the exclusion of women because they weren't money. Now, I'm getting close here to finishing up. And in the 1800s, all the way to 1920, when the 19th Amendment was finally passed and women were given the right to vote, lots of jokes, lots of things became part of the discussion. So the man is leaning back here in a nest of women saying, my dear creatures, if you want to fall behind the sexes, you must learn to be independent of us as we are of you. Now, we men live chiefly to please ourselves first and then each other, whereas you women live entirely to please us. Prevailing attitude. Prevailing attitude. Cartoon. Emotion. Lots was thrown out there. And this one, I believe, was in Punch, and it says, Election Day. Poor daddy's holding the babies and the cat's under the chair yelling and mama's dressed up in rock art. Another emotional poster. Women bring all voters into the world like women vote. And in front of the White House, women picketed Woodrow Wilson. Mr. President, what will you do for women's suffrage? So during leading up to the time that women got the vote, there was a lot of propaganda both ways. And that emotional stuff that I started with continues yet, as we well know. Now, much has happened. I stop here. Much has happened between achievement of suffrage and today. But I still don't have an answer to my original why. And I don't think the study of philosophy can give me a satisfactory answer. I've tried. I've gone through as many as I can. But it does provide, furnish, I think, a perspective on the history of ideas. Like turning the cube to see all sides, points of view, angles of vision. And if you look at the history, if you look at psychology, sociology, religion, anthropology, biology, DNA, all of that put together, we may begin to get some answers. But I don't see one answer to why women have been oppressed for so long. Statistics. You know that we're now up to 8.5 cents on the dollar. Move it up. At the current rate, we're going to reach equity by 2059.
All right, I'm sure people have questions for Nancy, so let's get started.
Well, this is not quite a question, but did you know that in New Zealand right now, they're celebrating 100 years since New Zealand became the first country in the world to give women the vote. And now they have a woman who's a prime minister, a young woman who's prime minister, just had a baby, and she takes it to Parliament to breastfeed it. So things are really
wow.
Changed. Wow.
Yeah. Wow. Of 195 countries, according to Google yesterday, only 15 are headed by women. And eight of those are the first woman their countries have had as a leader. Wow, New Zealand.
With regard to the First Timothy passage, yeah. There's some scholarship that would consider that not an authentic Pauline, the pseudo-Pauline. So do you make any distinction in your views, I guess, between the authentic Paul and then all the Pauline writings?
I don't know enough about it. What I do know is I have an evangelical friend who tells me that there's a lot of new scholarship on Paul. And there's one particular book, which I can't remember the name, that is written by a woman who really dissects Paul in a way that hasn't been done before. I think 15 years ago when Dylan and I had a student, she told me very clearly, you have to be careful when you talk about Paul. So I'm sorry, I have to say I don't know. I really don't know enough, but I do know that there is scholarship going on about it.
I wanted to ask if you could briefly address intersections where science has pushed back on some of this. I based my question on having heard a theologian discuss how it was a bit of a crisis for the church when they realized that women weren't just the fertile soil in which a seed was planted to have a child, but specifically for the Christ child, that Christ as a incarnate would have had half of his mother's DNA.
I don't know what the church did about that, but I believe they still hold the Immaculate Conception as being a doctrine of the church, right? I don't think they've given that up.
Right.
But anybody correct me, I'm not a religionist. But I can see that is, you know, science does cause you to think about things. And like I said, I'm just looking up this heat business. Yeah, I mean, they seem to think that, you know, normal temperatures that women, a normal temperature for a woman might be a couple of points lower.
I have a question about, you mentioned something about matriarchal or different types of societies prior to the Greeks. And recently I've started reading about those things. An archaeologist named Marija Gimbutas. Apparently some of these societies were incredibly, I mean, for hundreds of years, they weren't matriarchal, they were egalitarian.
Yeah.
And their cities didn't have armaments around them. And so that gave me some sense of hope that human beings aren't ultimately bad, growing into a better way of being, but that we're essentially good, and we just somehow lost our way against the Greeks or whoever.
You wonder what happened to those societies. Why did they fall apart? Now, of course, Guns, Germs, and Steel tells us a lot about that. Power, brute force, one way of living takes over. Maybe. That would be nice, wouldn't it? If it's not built into us, into our DNA.
You've talked mostly about Western society, European and American. And like you said, you know, there are other lots of societies. Most of this is really cultural, isn't it? But what do you say about the biological difference, the anthropological difference? You know, chimpanzees and bonobos, our closest relatives, are very, very different. The chimpanzees are very male-dominated, war, you know, bloodshed. The bonobos are very loving and maternalistic. So it's not purely biology, but certainly our evolutionary biology, sociology, has something to do with it, you know. And women are different hormonally.
Absolutely.
You know you're estrogen or androgen. So, vive la différence. So, does that have something to do with it?
Of course it does. It's got to have. And at least that's my position. I have a scant knowledge of the science. But I made the argument to a friend today who's very learned, a smart woman, and I said, you know, this could just be biology. I mean, it could be built into us in some way. Men are stronger. Men have to be the hunters. men have to go out and drag home the buffalo. And maybe that, you know, is somehow built into our evolutionary schema, that the superior strength of men led to the paternalism thing, you know, coming down the pipe. And her response was, there's plenty of women that can drag home a buffalo. So I don't know. I know that clearly there's differences, and science knows that.
There's another aspect of science that I guess the church is still a long way behind, and that is the idea that they put forward that the soul enters the moment of conception and a new person is being formed. But that comes into a contradiction when you notice that even after several days, that embryo can split into two and make a pair of identical twins. So then you have the paradox of who gets, they end up with only half a soul each. But actually, then you have another thing of the the tradition that men, or at least the social custom that's enforced by men, once they get power, they keep it, and it may have the switch from the early equalitarian status to male-dominated. Perhaps was because the earliest towns and cities were continually warring against each other, and the military, the male, the army, if you like, the warriors, learned to use force to fight the rival tribes, and that allowed them to use the same techniques in dominating the society.
Maybe it had something to do with survival species. That's interesting. I hadn't heard that half so long. Four twins.
In response to your thing about the men being the warriors, trailing behind them were all of the women and children when they went to war. So the women carried all the packs, did all the work, cooked all the food, took care of all the children, while the men rode the horses and went forward.
That was definitely revolutionary.
Not in a revolutionary.
But I think you're right that the women in the group are much more invested in raising children and nurturing them, and they would be supporting the men because the men were protecting them against whoever they were having a war with. So it was a natural division of labor, I think.
Well, you know, and there's always the admiration. And there's Joan of Arc. Now, that's not somebody we don't see a lot of Joan of Arc. But there are always those women that can do.
Just a little addition to that. So this doesn't include neatly useless. So the peace strategy doesn't include neatly useless sexes, right? The armies are supported by both sexes. They're supported by slaves. They're supported by, you know, whole groups of people that have nothing to do with that gender. And there are also lots of societies that have women who have fought in the military, like Sparta. One of the famous facts about ancient Sparta was that they actually militarily trained their women. But, you know, in part because they were vulnerable when their men were equipped, right? They were vulnerable to outside threats. So I think you've done a really nice job laying this out. A couple of suggestions. I mean, the real scandal here is that you've got a whole history of philosophy. And their thoughts on this topic are so unimaginative. They're so unimaginative. I mean, they're really just, I mean, I'm going to disagree with your thesis a little bit. I think it's not the case that the societies that they were in were adopting their ideas about females. It's really better that they were just expropriating and just saying, repeating what was already.
The thing about these, what these philosophers said, you have to dig for it to find it in their work. It is not what is brought forth in the everyday intro to philosophy book. You know, it's, you have to read it carefully to find what they really thought about it.
and because they didn't think it as an interesting question.
Yeah.
It was a question that was secondary to the way it happens, but so it was a question. I'm finally an ignorant person, I apologize.
You went up to you and just...
Wait a minute. I've got a question coming back here. I'll bring it to the microphone in just a second.
I'm sorry, just one second. I thought we had a really nice avenue at a few parts about the control of the technique of reproduction. That is, with maintenance of families, maintenance of the next generation, maintenance of the society. And I think that does get to a whole nexus of separate issues that make those some of the sisters be involved.
Yeah, I think that's a deeply psychological piece. Has to be.
What do you anticipate will be developing in the next decade or two?
Gosh, I don't know. I think we have a daughter who is in high tech, and she is a minority in high tech. In Silicon Valley, only 11% of women hold executive positions. In the tech industry in general, that's pretty close to true. So, I don't know. It's not moving very fast. And at what point, you know, if we have to go to 2059 to get to dollar for dollar, I'm not terribly optimistic that things are going to turn on the dime and go fast. Maybe in the far distant future.
I was in India a year ago, and I was talking to a guy who's female, and nearly everybody in India that drives is male. Maybe 95% of the drivers are male. And I was asking our guy, a delightful young woman, who would you like to drive? And she said, well, there's no laws against it, but there's this peer pressure, societal pressure, that you know, she doesn't drive. The same thing's happening in Saudi Arabia there. Legally, women are now going to be able to drive, but the societal pressure, religious pressure, peer pressure is such that, for example, like a woman that wanted to drive in Saudi Arabia, as I understand it, might have a very difficult time finding a husband. So what is your, you said this, it was an outstanding presentation, what is your prescription on how we tackle problems like that? Do we try and do it legally? Through the churches, what would be your prescription?
You know, that's an interesting question. And when I think about other parts of the world, like Saudi and India, and I think about how advanced, in quotes, we seem to be in the United States, and I think of what we have gone through to get there. The women's movement wasn't a pretty thing. I mean, women were tortured, literally held down and force-fed in England, and I mean, it wasn't an easy thing. And I was speaking this weekend with an activist, a social activist minister, and he basically believes nothing happens until violence occurs. That you've got to get out there and put yourself in front of the tank, you know, like in Beijing, or you've got to throw yourself under the immigration bus. And maybe that's what it takes to change society. Maybe it takes an uprising. But it's not going to be my generation. We're not going to do that. I'm not sure my daughters are of that. Maybe my granddaughter. I don't know. I don't know that there's a prescription other than you got to keep talking about it and you got to keep fighting it. And one of the words I hate the most in my students is, oh, he wrote that to raise awareness. Well, what do you do with it when it's raised? You know, you got to go out and you got to act on it.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And that's social action. That's social justice. And there's not enough people who are willing to put themselves in harm's way. And that's,
well, at least the blacks and the gays have done that.
And the women's movement did that. And so the movements that make changes usually involve bodily harm.
Unions.
Yeah, the unions also.
So to your point about the pay disparity, alleged pay disparity, is that what you said?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Alleged pay disparity, the 25 cents for every dollar made.
Yeah.
What's your perspective on the state theory's paper pertaining to gender equality paradox, where as the naturally choose less high-paying, less competitive industries which do participate?
I'm trying to think of an answer that doesn't involve an obscenity.
That's kind of what I expected. Similar note, it's probably going to be a similar kind of response. How do you address Shapley's actual arguments today with the prospect of if women are going to have equal rights, should they not be subject to draft? If there's true equality between the sexes, as we're seeing with the transgender movement, why do we have separate equity?
See, that's the really interesting thing about her and about those kind of arguments, is there is something to them. There is something that you have to consider there. You can't just blow it off and say, oh, that's silly, that's emotional, that's it. They can't really do that. Now, if we were in such a national crisis that women needed to serve, I believe they would. You know, they probably would not flock to... Of course they do. And, you know, I think our Veterans Affairs Office at Brookhaven has his name really involved in as men. I mean, so I think a draft probably wouldn't be the frightening thing. Questions? I don't know. I mean, there's...
Yeah, a draft forces you to fight. But I think there's plenty of women who are fighting who choose to get into want to get into combat, and it's been a big struggle for them to get that right. So it's not, I think the draft is a matter of being forced to do something that isn't appropriate.
Well, I don't know much about that argument, but I know that there's, you know, part of the argument is, oh, women are too small to carry those heavy packs. Well, couldn't those packs be lightened? It's like, could we use aluminum or something instead of, you know, heavy steel? I don't know. I mean, is that an absolute? Is the strength of the woman the absolute factor there?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah, I don't.
I was in the Army. I can tell you there's a very significant disparity in upper body strength between men and women. And frontline combat military is all about moving heavy shit from one place to another faster than they can.
And between Germans and Asians, which is why the Asians don't have military.
Well, but my first thought about that, and it's just, man, this was brainstorming. I mean, women don't have to be on the front lines. They can be hand punch shooting. They can drop the bomb, or they can be strategists, absolutely. So
I was in the Navy 6 years, and I didn't carry anything that it was that my wife couldn't carry. Yeah. I got a question.
But your wife could drag home the buffaloes.
Yeah. What do you see the next Congress looking like, and does that give you hope?
There is the Fifth Amendment.
I'm sorry?
There is the Fifth Amendment.
There is the Fifth Amendment. That's right. I don't know. I hope that people exercise the franchise. I hope people actually get out and vote, which has always been our problem in the United States. We have a lower percentage of people who actually vote. And in Australia, isn't it the law?
Yes. You got to vote. In Australia, you have to vote.
Yeah.
They'll
find you and put you in jail. So we got time for about one more question.
I actually can go on and on with this topic for hours, but I don't think it'll let us get here. The thing is, you know, I'm not big enough to kill a buffalo, but I can make sure the buffalo gets home if they want to. What I'm trying to say is, I'm smart enough to do a job that probably is done by a man. And not only that, you know, to answer your question, women don't want to get jobs. There are women who don't have children. There are women who are not married. There are lesbians. There are women who are done with their husbands. They all want good paying, good jobs. I am a high-tech woman. I have been asked many times to dumb down my resume. I have been asked that I have been said, like, mom, that you're too smart. Yes, I am, unfortunately, for you. But the thing is, kinds of people. There are smart women, there are smart men. Why are we at this stage in 2018? Why is that that women are not allowed to make choices for their bodies on how we want to, whether we want to have kids or not, about the pay, and why is that we cannot elect a woman president? Why is that we cannot elect women officials? Why is that women attack other women? What's wrong?
See, this is a question that I cannot answer, and I don't think philosophy yields the answer. I think we've got to look all at a whole bunch of other things. You know, not the least being culture, power structures, economics, a willingness to give up power.
Because every time we talk about rights, somebody has to guarantee those rights. Somebody with enough power and resources to make sure that those rights are represented. And you know, we do a lot of talk about women's rights, but everybody in this room, before we were men and women, we were children. You know, children come in male and female and intersex, I guess we should conclude. The thing is, who guarantees children's rights in a society? And, I mean, that's the fundamental question that I keep coming back to, because much of what we're talking about women's rights includes children along for the bargain. You know, just biologically, we're encumbered and we're vulnerable at a certain stage of our life. And this is just an inescapable reality with all human societies and that contention.
I'm sure Nancy will be glad to talk about this with the, we've got to clear this room out. Shut us down. So if you have something else you'd like to ask, please come do. We have a token of the Oscar's Walk Appreciation, the Cromfield School of Athens. Thank you. See you in a couple weeks. You know, Aristotle's father.